Chapter 28. I was sitting in my pants on my sofa, eating Kung Po chicken direct from the container, when I realised that maybe I wasn't exactly smashing it coping-wise. Oliver had been at his parents' house, well, his mum's house now, for almost a week, dealing with death logistics. And it wasn't like we hadn't been in contact. There'd been texts and a couple of phone calls, but Oliver had seemed distant. Which I got, because between the administrative faff of arranging a cremation, the emotional sucker punch of your father dropping dead not long after you told him to go fuck himself, and, oh yes, that enormous fight we'd been in the middle of, he had a lot on his mind. I just wished he'd let me, I don't know, be there, help, do something, feel less useless. Except I guess that was kind of selfish. The thing was, in all the time we'd been together, there'd never been a point in our relationship when what Oliver had needed from me was absence. Space, occasionally, sure, when work was demanding, or when I was being annoying. But this was different. Like, I had no idea what he was thinking, and there was some tiny, messed-up part of my brain that was worried he was hating me. Because if going to bed angry was bad for your relationship, going to organise your father's funeral angry had to be a whole other level of fucked up. In any case, Oliver was in Milton Keynes, and I was backsliding with alarming rapidity, which meant I was actually that guy, the one who could only keep it together if he had someone to keep it together for. And at some point, Oliver was going to come home and find me unconscious in a pile of old socks and pizza boxes, and then be all, "Not only did you destroy my relationship with my family and question the authenticity of my identity over a rainbow balloon arch, but you are also a human refuse pile with less self-respect than one of those fish that spends its whole life attached to a larger fish feeding on its leftovers." Except he'd just say, "A remora," and assume I knew what it was. And then I'd have to say, "What's a remora?" And he'd say, "It's a fish, Lucian, that spends its whole life attached to a larger fish feeding on its leftovers." Probably I needed to stop watching The Blue Planet while angsty. Tipping what was left of my rice into what was left of my Kung Po sauce, I made a glum and futile pact with myself to stop being so shit. Because nobody who had recently celebrated his 30th birthday, and by celebrated, I mean panicked about, should be going to pieces after less than a week of having to make his own French toast. Not that I made my own French toast. Even if I'd been able to make it as well as Oliver, it wouldn't have tasted the same without him. Fuck. I had to do something. So I pulled out my phone and messaged the WhatsApp group, currently called Stand By Your Pan. "Help," I typed. "Oliver has gone away for like 5 seconds, and I am eating takeaway in my pants." Bridge responded immediately.
"How is Oliver? I heard about his dad. Sad face."
Trying to talk about someone's dead parents in all caps created tonal issues that even I was sensitive to. "I think he's okay. He's not really talking to me."
"Why?" asked Priya. "Is there takeaway in your pants?"
"I'm in my pants. The takeaway is in my mouth."
"If I come round to be supportive and shit, will you at least put trousers on?"
"He's sad. He doesn't have to wear trousers if he's sad."
"Sorry." That was James Royce-Royce. "James can't make it because he's at the restaurant, and I can't make it because I have to look after baby Jay."
"Bring baby Jay, it'll be cute. Luke can't be sad if there's a baby."
For someone who knew me better than anyone, sometimes Bridge didn't know me at all.
"Nobody is taking my baby boy to Luke's flat."
That was James Royce-Royce, somehow texting from a professional kitchen.
"He'll crawl into a pile of laundry and die."
"My flat is clean these days," I protested. An incredulous digital silence followed. Then a message popped up from Priya.
Only because you don't live there.
That was depressingly close to the truth. Keeping the flat clean by the cunning strategy of staying full-time at Oliver's had worked remarkably well. But I'd been back for 4 days now, and it was 4 days in which I had done approximately zero washing up.
He's sad. You always let things slide when you're sad.
Luke must have been sad a lot.
Well, I'm sad now, I typed. Come and comfort me.
Fine. Should I bring chocolate or bleach?
I winced. Maybe both?
I'm on my way right now. Don't start without me.
Don't start what? I asked.
Anything.
I made the executive decision that anything, in this context, didn't include putting on my trousers. So I did, and made a desultory start on the washing up. Except washing up reminded me of Oliver, which probably said all kinds of weird things about my habits, both in the relationship and outside of it. I just missed him. And his 3 different types of sponges for washing specific types of things. And the way I'd hug him from behind instead of doing the drying, and we'd both pretend it was 100% affection instead of 80% affection and 20% laziness. Definitely not crying, I threw away my takeaway container and realised I'd thrown the fork away with it. In retrospect, that might have explained why I had so few forks. What if I was never going to wash up with Oliver again? What if he dumped me, because every time he looked at me, he saw his dead dad? And then what if every time I looked at a bottle of fairy liquid, I saw the guy who dumped me for yelling at him for caring too much about what his parents thought at the exact moment one of those parents was dying of a heart attack? The buzzer went, and, somewhat predictably, Priya stomped in.
Where's Bridge?
She asked. I shrugged. She said she was on her way right now, which means she'll be here in about an hour. Slipping her army kit bag from her shoulder, Priya pulled out a bar of dairy milk and a bottle of Dettol antibacterial spray.
So,
she flopped down on the end of the sofa.
How fucked is your relationship?
Wow, I really missed your sunny, supportive disposition.
Fuck off, Luke. I brought beer.
What's that saying? Beer, then wine, feeling fine. Beer, then antibacterial spray will ruin your day. She laughed and rummaged again in her bag, finally producing a 4-pack of whatever craft IPA she was into this week.
Seriously, though.
Flicking open the bottle opener attachment of her Swiss Army knife, she beered us both.
How fucked is it?
I sighed. Honestly, I can't tell. Oliver's never been like this with me. But then, his dad's never died, so who knows?
In other words, Priya said, everything's fine and you're just getting in your head like a wanker.
Sitting down next to Priya, I cast her a you have failed to comfort me look. How have you got 2 girlfriends? Or indeed any non-zero number of girlfriends?
Because they like that I'm creative, low bullshit, and get them off. In my experience, that's what women are after.
Good to know, although not super relevant to me right now. She took a long draught of a beer with a weird name.
And, just to cover the basics, you've tried, like, talking to him and shit?
I've tried, but he's not really talking to me.
I'll admit that would normally be a sign, because you're in one of those annoying mature relationships where you have to make plans and share your feelings instead of just screaming and fucking. But...
And here Priya, who was being more serious than I was used to, fortified herself with some more beer.
Grief's its own thing. He's probably feeling a lot of mixed stuff right now, especially because, from what you've said, his dad was a prick.
You'd think, I said, that would make it easier. I mean, not to blow my own trumpet, but I'm kind of an expert on dads who are pricks, and when John Fleming finally gets prostate cancer for real, I will give zero shits. Priya clicked her tongue stud against her teeth.
Speaking as an artist, I don't think anyone gets to be an expert on emotions. Your thing with your dad is your thing with your dad. Oliver's thing with his dad is his thing with his dad, and they aren't going to work the same.
Oh my God. I stared at her in horror. When did you start getting nuance?
When I stopped being 21, pay attention.
She smirked.
Besides, I'll have you know that The Guardian says I have a profound insight into the human condition.
Doesn't The Guardian say that about everybody vaguely left-wing and artsy? I pointed out. To which her profound insight into the human condition enabled her to craft the eloquent rebuttal of,
"Fuck off."
It was about then that the buzzer buzzed again, and Bridge staggered up in a flurry of bags and apologies.
"I'm really, really sorry,"
she told us, unloading a bottle of 12.99 wine, another bar of dairy milk. There was a sort of unspoken code that comfort chocolate wasn't allowed to have any distracting flavours in it. A bunch of wilted supermarket flowers and a box of Tesco rocket lollies.
"Also, I panic shopped, and I would have been here sooner, but I was in such a hurry to get here that I jumped on a train without checking which branch it was going down and didn't realise until I hit Bayswater."
She tore open the box of rocket lollies, fished one out, and thrust it in my face.
"These are great. Try one."
Knowing better than to spurn a rocket lolly offered in a spirit of friendship, I obediently peeled open the slightly sticky plastic wrap and began nibbling. The tip was strawberry-flavoured, or rather it was that generic red flavour that coded as strawberry by default. There was something so childish about it. Brightly coloured, mildly flavoured frozen water served from a slightly soggy box, that it was, in fact, weirdly comforting. It was very hard to have a serious crisis of relationship confidence while you were sucking on a rocket lolly.
"Now tell me everything,"
Bridge cried.
"What happened? What about the wedding?"
Since I still had a face full of rocket lolly, Priya answered for me.
"Nothing's happened. Oliver's just gone a bit weird on account of his dad dying, and Luke's freaking out because he can't cope with emotions."
Bridge's eyes were wide.
"Oliver's gone weird? What kind of weird? And what about the wedding?"
"The kind of weird," Priya explained, "you go when your dad drops dead of a heart attack a few months after he found out you were marrying a guy you knew he didn't like. And also he was a cock, but now he's dead and you're not allowed to think he's a cock anymore."
Bridge's eyes showed no signs of de-widening.
"Does this mean the wedding's off?"
"Bridge," I finally managed to extricate myself from the lolly, "we haven't discussed it." Technically, we'd been discussing it, and that was part of the problem. But we were having an argument seemed such a petty thing compared to a bereavement. "The wedding's not a priority right now. Probably it'll be fine, but if Oliver decides he can't go through with it, I'll support him."
"But you're not meant to support him," Bridge insisted. "Not if he wants to call the wedding off. Then you're supposed to fight for him. You're meant to say, 'No, I love you more than anything in the universe, and we're meant to be together forever.' And then he says, 'You're right, I've been a fool, a mad, impetuous fool.'"
I divided my attention between a lolly in one hand and a beer in the other. And that was some duality of man shit right there. "Firstly, if there's one thing Oliver isn't, it's a mad, impetuous fool. Secondly, he'd never say mad, impetuous fool, because he'd be concerned it could be considered ableist. Thirdly, demanding Oliver put marrying me above dealing with his father's death is a total dick move."
"Not if you really are meant to be together forever."
Priya looked up.
"No, it's still a dick move. Partly because meant to be is bollocks. And partly because if it wasn't bollocks and you were meant to be together forever, you'd be together forever whether you got married or not."
"I know,"
Bridge subsided sadly.
"It's just Luke was going to get married and, well..."
If he blows this,
Priya put in,
he's fucked, because no one else will have him.
I would have defended myself, but secretly, I kind of agreed. It wasn't that I was with Oliver because I thought there was no other option. It was just that imagining non-Oliver options made my heart vomit.
That's not true,
Bridge was yelling.
Luke's lovely.
No, he's not. He's a complete wanker.
Well, so are you. I got back in the game. And you've got two girlfriends. Priya shrugged.
As established. Cool job. Brilliant at sex.
I'm brilliant at sex, I insisted. Her eyes met mine and called bullshit on them.
Are you, Luke? Are you really?
I thought about it. I'd had a lot of sex, and honestly, it had been pretty contextual. In the sense of whether it was good or not, had more to do with who, when, where, and how, rather than technical prowess of either party. Solid B+, I said.
Yeah.
Priya opened a second beer.
Figures.
Chapter 29. Half an hour later, my flat was looking worse, but I was feeling better. That's the thing about mess. A stack of unwashed dishes says, I hate myself, and you should hate me too. But the pile of empty bottles next to a scattering of chocolate wrappers and ice lolly boxes said, I hate myself, but I have people in my life who remind me I shouldn't. And we definitely think, I said, taking what remained of the wine from Bridge's hands and swigging direct from the bottle, that this is an I'm grieving situation, not an I'm taking the opportunity to bail because I'm too polite to dump you situation. Having finished the beer, Priya grabbed the wine from me and took a swig of her own.
I know Oliver's repressed, but I think even he would stop short of having his own father killed just to get out of a relationship.
Maybe his father dying was a coincidence and he made the most of it, I suggested.
No,
cried Bridge. She'd been crying things all evening.
You and Oliver are perfect for each other and you're perfect together and everything's going to be perfect.
If we're so perfect, I asked, why is he in Milton Keynes being sad without me? For a moment, Bridge didn't have a reply. Then her face lit up like a Christmas tree, which, ironically, it also did any time she looked at a Christmas tree.
I've got it!
You're going to say, go to Milton Keynes, aren't you?
Priya's voice wasn't exactly scornful, but had a quality that suggested scorn would be an option.
Why not?
Asked Bridge.
He's there and he's lonely, and for whatever silly reason he feels like he can't reach out. His cur is all creeing and he needs you, Luke. He needs you.
There was a part of me that wanted her to be right, for this thorny mess of grief and antagonism to be fixable with one big gesture. What if he needs space?
Well, which is worse?
Bridge turned her hands into wobbly scales.
If he needs you and you're not there, or if you're there and he doesn't need you?
I think, I said slowly, it wouldn't be so much there and he doesn't need me as making his father's death all about my insecurities. Priya shot me a sardonic look.
To be fair, you totally are.
But, I wagged a crucial point-making finger, not to his face.
Wow, said Priya, you really have grown.
Reclaiming the wine bottle, Bridge leapt somewhat unsteadily to her feet.
I still think that we should go to Milton Keynes right now.
And who's going to drive you? Asked Priya. Because I'm quite drunk, and also don't want to.
Bridge bounced undeterred.
We'll get an Uber.
Oliver would hate that, I reminded her. We'd be intruding on his private grief, and the grief of his family who dislike me, while using the services of a company whose business practices he disapproves of. Deflating slightly, Bridget lowered herself back onto the sofa.
I want to say it would be so romantic that it wouldn't matter, but it would matter, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I sighed. It really would.
Why is everything so complicated?
Bridge wondered piteously.
It wasn't like this when we were younger.
I gave her a drunken pat. I think it was. I just think we didn't notice. Which, I cast my mind back a decade, might explain why we made so many terrible, terrible mistakes.
Speak for yourself, said Priya. I stand by every mistake I've ever made.
For a while we passed around the dregs of the wine and commiserated. We didn't have any real answers for each other, not about the Oliver situation, or about the wedding situation, or about the why-is-everything-so-hard-suddenly situation. But there was a comfort in knowing that, in the tiny space of my flat at least, we were all in the same boat, that we were all in an equally bemused state of making shit up as we went along and then throwing it at the wall to see if it stuck, which was probably a mixed metaphor, but fuck it, I'd been drinking. So, how is marriage? I asked Bridge eventually, mostly because once we'd decided that we weren't doing a highly irresponsible overnight and over-the-legal-limit drive to Milton Keynes to save a relationship that might not even need saving, she'd started looking almost as down as I felt.
Oh, it's wonderful, she said.
She didn't have wonderful face.
But...
For a while we waited for her to continue. When it became clear she wasn't, Priya asked,
Wonderful but what?
Perhaps she was just bragging that Tom has a wonderful butt, I suggested, in a vain attempt to lighten the mood. Which, to be fair, he does. Bridge nodded, slightly less glum than 90 seconds ago.
He does, and it is. I mean, married life, not Tom's ass. I mean, also Tom's ass. It's just... The wedding was so magical, and the honeymoon was so, so magical. But then we got back, and it was... Well, carrying on as normal.
Aren't you buying a house together? I asked. That's pretty fresh starty.
In theory, but I work full-time, and he works full-time, and the market is a mess, and there are chains and things, so we can't even put a deposit down into my little flat sales, and we've had two buyers drop out already, and...
She sighed.
It's so fiddly. Who decided that being happy forever with the person you love most in the universe had to be fiddly?
Sometimes I thought Bridge's die-hard romanticism in the face of my self-obsession was a deliberate strategy to draw me out of myself, and most of the time... It worked. To be fair, I said, when you put it that way, it actually sounds like a decent trade.
Apart from the loving somebody more than anybody else in the world part, added Priya, that bit can go fuck itself.
Bridget's eyes widened.
But what's the point if...
Priya cut her off.
Bridge, I know you're just being sweet and enthusiastic, but you do remember I'm with two people right now, yeah? And I don't love either of them more than the other.
She upended the wine, found it empty, and tossed it casually into one of my many tossing piles.
Or, for that matter, more than I love my mum, or my dad, or my sister.
You've got a sister?
Bridge asked, surprised but weirdly happy. She didn't like other people's families quite as much as she liked other people's romantic partners, but it was a close-run thing.
Yeah. You'd get on. She's really normal. Works in a bank. Anyway, the point is that I'd appreciate it if you toned down the nobody can be happy without that one special person thing, just like this much.
Priya held her fingers so close together, they were practically touching.
Because honestly, I feel sort of judged.
The only thing in the world that made Bridge sadder than her friends being sad was the idea that she might have had a part in making her friend sad. With a wail of apology, she dropped the tail end of the dairy milk she'd been picking on and threw her arms around Priya.
I'm so sorry. I'm stupid and thoughtless and a bad friend and a bad...
Okay, easy, Tiger.
Priya was giving Bridge the kind of friendly pat on the back that looked a bit like she was tapping out of a submission hold.
I'm a big girl and can look after myself. I just wanted you to be a smidge less... normative, is all.
Still a little teary, but finally working out that she'd been aggressively hugging somebody who wasn't super keen on being hugged, Bridge pulled back.
And I suppose, really, she said, you're even luckier than Luke and me, because you've found your special someone twice.
Priya leaned around Bridge and gave me a conspiratorial look.
I've made it worse, haven't I?
Probably. Bridge settled back on the sofa.
Made what worse? I just...
From the hallway, there came the sound of the door opening, and for about 18 seconds, we were convinced it was burglars. 18 seconds, it turned out, was exactly enough time for Bridge to take cover behind a chair, me to stand around gawping like one of those sharks with the big mouths, and Priya to vanish into the kitchen, only to return with the largest, sharpest knife I owned. 3 seconds later, it became clear that it wasn't burglars at all. For a start, we could hear them taking their shoes off and hanging up their coat, and it seemed very unlikely that a burglar would bother with those kinds of details. And to clinch it, we also heard a voice call out,
"Lucien, are you home?"
"Should we leave?"
mouthed Bridget, to which Priya mouthed back,
"Yes, obviously."
While I was busy mouthing, "It's fine."
"I meant a text on the way,"
Oliver was saying as he came closer.
"But I suppose I forgot. I've been rather busy lately."
There was still something off in his voice. But of course there was. Like he'd said, he'd been busy lately, and "my actual dad actually died" was one hell of an excuse for being a bit awkward for a couple of weeks. The sitting room door opened, and the three of us did our best to give Oliver the impression we hadn't been having an intense conversation about what was wrong with him for the last several hours.
"Hi,"
waved Bridge and Priya, more or less in unison. Oliver blinked. He looked exhausted. Properly used up, nothing left exhausted.
"Hello. Lovely to see you. Why are you armed?"
Priya made an apologetic gesture with the carving knife.
"Thought you were burglars."
"I suppose."
Oliver ran a hand distractedly through his hair.
"This is the wrong time to talk about lethal force in defence of property."
She shrugged.
"Up to you. I was sort of thinking you'd want Bridge and me to leave."
"You're welcome to stay," he said at once.
I might have been projecting, but I thought exposure to his parents, well, parent now, always set him about 3 steps backwards on the can't say no scale.
"That's code for please leave, isn't it?"
observed Priya, passing me the carving knife.
"Not at all," Oliver lied.
"Well, I'm getting tired anyway,"
declared Bridge, slightly too loudly to sound even remotely sincere.
"So, I should be going home. Good night, Luke."
She hugged me, just about managing to let me put the knife down first.
"Good night, Oliver."
She hugged him, rather tighter and longer.
"I was so sorry to hear about your father."
He hugged her back in a way I was trying not to read as dead inside.
"Thank you, Bridget."
"If you need anything..."
She gazed up at him earnestly.
"Or if Luke needs anything, or you want to talk or not talk..."
"Thank you, Bridget,"
he said again.
"You have to reach out to people,"
she went on.
"You can't lock everything up inside forever, or you'll end up like Luke."
I'd been in the process of returning the knife to the kitchen, but now I swung back. "Oi, I'm doing great these days. And it only took me, like, 5 years.
"I'm not talking to you, Luke. I'm talking to Oliver."
Bridge gave him one last squeeze.
"We're here for you."
Priya swung her kit bag over her shoulder.
She's here for you. I don't know you that well, so I think it would be weird.
I appreciate it,
said Oliver, still incapacitated with politeness. Eventually, Priya dragged Bridge out the door, leaving me alone with the distant, emotionally distraught boyfriend I wasn't totally sure wanted to see me. And having spent a week wishing Oliver was here so I could do something, I found myself wishing I knew what that something actually was. We stared at each other, like every easy habit we'd built up over the last few years suddenly didn't count.
Sorry.
Oliver cast a weary glance around my flat.
I think I interrupted something.
I couldn't work out if telling him I'd had an I was sad without you party would be reassuring or guilt-trippy. We were just hanging out. I mean, I gazed at him helplessly. Like, how are you? He was silent for a couple of months.
I'm tired. And I...
Do you hate me? I blurted out. Did I ruin your relationship with your father? Did we leave everything in a bad place? Are we broken now? And I'm making it all about me.
Honestly, you are making it a little all about you.
I thought he was trying to smile, but I might have just been wanting him to really, really hard. Fuck. Shit, sorry. Do I at least get self-awareness points for realizing that?
That's making it slightly more all about you.
I cringed. Sorry, I suck. For the first time in what felt like forever, he almost laughed.
You don't suck, Lucien. I realize I've probably been worrying recently, and I shouldn't have done that to you.
Oh, God. His dad was dead and he was being reassuring. I did not deserve this man in any way. No. You've got to let yourself take your time and feel your feels or whatever. And this must be so fucked up.
Yes.
There was something in his voice, something more there than when he'd come in.
I suspect I'm still working out quite how fucked up it is.
That had only half been what I meant. And, well, having a massive fight before you went couldn't have helped.
It wasn't ideal.
He'd stopped smiling, but it didn't seem like he was going to dump me on the spot, which was the closest thing to a win I felt I could reasonably expect. I hope, I tried, it wasn't in your head too much. Like, I know we got kind of heated, and it might have felt like I don't... Like I'm not on your side. But I am. And I'm totally here for you and stuff, even if we're fighting. You do know that, right? For a moment, Oliver looked like he was wrestling with something. But at last he said,
I sometimes let myself forget, but in general, I do.
It wasn't a ringing endorsement, but there was a mild tinkle to it.
I think, he went on, we both said some things that we shouldn't have, but perhaps they needed saying anyway.
I couldn't tell if that was ominous or comforting. Needed saying. He gave a sad little shrug.
This may be just another habit of mine I've inherited from my parents, but I tend to believe that the things which feel worst are the things which feel truest. That doesn't mean they always are, but I've been thinking about what you said, and...
And? I tried not to sound too hopeful.
And...
His face got all blank and exhausted again.
I don't have any answers.
That's okay, I said quickly.
I confess it bothers me somewhat. But I'm also aware that now is not the best time for me to be interrogating my values for authenticity. I should probably bury my father first.
I felt beyond bad for him. I mean, we'd had an argument over something that, in retrospect, was completely fucking trivial. So what if I liked rainbows and balloons, and he liked podcasts and hanging out with straight people? All that mattered was that we loved each other, and his dad was dead. And here was Oliver still steadfastly trying to become a better person because of some bullshit I'd yelled at him a week ago. I gave a kind of can-we-hug-now flail. I'm really glad you came back.
I wasn't going to live at my mother's.
I meant emotionally, you doink. Crossing the room, he pulled me into his arms, and we hugged for an embarrassingly long time.
I missed you, he whispered.
I missed you too, I whispered back. And I'm so sorry things are shit for you. He pressed his face against my neck.
I can't think about it anymore, at least not right now.
You don't have to, I told him. We can do whatever.
Would it?
His voice wavered.
Resurrect your belief that I'm the most boring man in the universe, if I said I wanted to go to bed.
Well, I had got us tickets to Alton Towers, but I can move them to another day. This time he did laugh, although it had an edge of my dad's still dead to it. So I took his hand and led him through the bedroom. Also, I added, the advantage of me practically living at your place is that my sheets have barely been slept in. He shrugged off his jacket and flopped, otherwise fully clothed, onto the bed.
At the moment, Lucien, all I care about is being with you.
Which was convenient, because while there weren't many things I was confident I could do well, being me was one of them. I think if I'd let him, Oliver would have passed out where he'd fallen. But because I knew from experience that waking up in your clothes from the night before felt awful, I half coaxed, half bullied him undressed. Then I slid into bed beside him and pulled the duvet over us both. We lay there for a little while, with me desperately trying to think of something consoling to say that wasn't just shit. Like, it'll be okay, or everything happens for a reason, or he was a cock anyway. So finally I went with, I love you, because it was true and safe and wouldn't make him think about the thing he didn't want to think about. He murmured my name and pressed in close, his face a sharp angled shadow in the darkness of the room. Yeah, definitely not a word situation. Carefully, I pushed back the tousled waves of his hair, letting my fingers move in long strokes through the strands. He gave another little murmur, half sad, half soothed, and tilted his head towards me on the pillow. Very gently, I kissed him. Not a hello you kiss, or a do me now kiss, but the sort of kiss that speaks for you. A kiss to draw us together, to show I was there, to promise I always would be, if he'd let me. And afterwards, Oliver settled into my arms as if he belonged there. And we stayed that way until morning. Chapter 30. If there was ever evidence that Oliver was in a bad way, it was that not only was he still asleep when I woke up, but he was still asleep when I got bored of lying in bed, which I thought was basically impossible. Easing myself out from under the duvet as quietly as I could so I wouldn't disturb him, I surreptitiously dressed and sort of, somehow, found myself standing there looking at him. Like that bit in a country song where the singer is all, "Honey, I love you, but something inside me means I gotta go and do a man thing. And I hope when I come back, you and little Ellie Mae will be waiting for me." And then I'd die in the second to last verse. And the last verse would be me going, "Dang nabbit, why did I have to do a man thing instead of staying at home with my wife and little Ellie Mae?"
"Are you staring at me, Lucien?" asked Oliver drowsily. Are you watching me sleep?
Oh, fuck. Only technically. I was mostly thinking, gosh, I wish I could do something to make Oliver feel better. And you just happened to be in my line of sight. And you just happened to be asleep.
Oliver shifted the pillows into a more ergonomic position.
I don't think there's anything you can do, but thank you for offering.
I'll leave you to not be stared at.
He made a vaguely grateful noise and rolled over, and I slipped out, closing the door behind me. Which meant instead of standing by the bed, not really knowing what to do with myself, I was standing in my flat, not really knowing what to do with myself. So, in the absence of a big green button labelled, "Press here to fix boyfriend," I cleaned. It didn't bring me quite the same sense of virtuous peace that it brought Oliver, but it was nice to know that when he woke up, he would be in a space that resembled a human dwelling and not a combination laundry basket litter bin. When I was done, he still wasn't up, partly because the job was a lot smaller than it had been last time I'd attempted a major flat tidy, and partly because, see above, re bad way. It was, however, getting to the point that I thought he might want to eat something. But looking in my fridge, I found there was nothing in it that wasn't 6 months past its use-by date, an animal product, or, in an embarrassingly large number of cases, both. There was a jar of gherkins, because fridges spontaneously generate gherkins even when nobody buys them. Except I didn't think materialising at Oliver's bedside saying, "Hello, darling, I know your father's died and you're having a lot of complicated emotions, but I've brought you a Wally," was quite the supportive and or romantic gesture he needed quite then. Then I had a genius idea. I would make him French toast, to show that this was a relationship where there was, like, space for each of us to be the French toaster or the French toastie. Then I remembered that there were two tiny flaws in that plan, the first being that I was a god-awful cook, and the second being that the main ingredients of French toast were milk and eggs. But you know what? Fuck it. It was the thought that counted, and there were vegan versions of everything these days. Leaving Oliver a note saying, "Gone shopping, have not run away to be cowboy, back soon," I headed out into the crisp November noon. The recipe I'd hastily Googled while heading downstairs to the street required chia seeds, agave nectar, and almond milk, and I had no idea where I'd get any of those. Fortunately, I lived in one of those bits of London where you couldn't walk 20 paces without tripping over a Whole Foods store or an artisanal cheese stand, so I was pretty confident I'd be able to source them without too much trouble. Besides, they sold half this stuff in Tesco. Part of me was a bit concerned that almond milk was supposed to be an ethical no-no, although I couldn't remember why, or if I was getting it mixed up with palm oil, but I decided that from Oliver's perspective at least, it was preferable to cow. In the end, the ingredient I had most trouble with was sturdy bread, because I had no idea what that meant, and didn't want my French toast to fall apart in the pan. But for some reason, when you went up to somebody in a shop and said, "How sturdy is your bread?" they thought you were taking the piss. The internet told me I should be using brioche, but it also told me that brioche wasn't vegan unless you got a specific brand, and that brand only made burger buns. In the end, I went for sourdough, on the grounds that if a bread that you could use to subdue an intruder in an emergency wasn't sturdy enough, nothing was. Back at the flat, I took the extremely sensible and grown-up precaution of opening all the windows and taking the batteries out of the smoke alarm. And then I got to it. To my joy, the first step of the recipe was basically stick everything except the bread in a bowl and stick the bowl in the fridge. And I could definitely do that. I mean, yes, I probably put in too much cinnamon because I dropped the spoon, but then cinnamon was one of those ingredients you could never have too much of. Like, you know, ginger or garlic. Oh, God. I'd inherited my mum's cooking genes, hadn't I?
As if this realization wasn't terrifying enough, it belatedly occurred to me that while getting a nice expensive bread was cool, it meant that it wasn't sliced. And the phrase, the best thing since sliced bread, was a cliche for a reason. In the end, I wound up cutting the loaf into roughly a dozen irregularly shaped chunks, none of which could, in all honesty, be called slices. There was the end piece, which had the approximate dimensions of a butt plug. Then the next piece was as thick as my thumb at the top and thinner than my bread knife at the bottom. Then there were two bits that were mostly crumbs. One halfway decent slice that somehow got fat in the middle and thin at each end, and the rest was a mixture of wedges, triangles and lumps that I hoped, perhaps naively, would hold up fine in the pan. When the requisite fridge-leaving time had passed, I fished out my batter and began soaking my bread. The recipe suggested that 20 to 30 seconds aside would be fine, but I gave it a bit longer because I wanted to be sure. Some of the thinner slices, or the thinner bits of the thicker slices, fell apart almost at once, but I figured I still had enough for an okay breakfast. One by one, I transferred the slices of vanilla and cinnamon-infused bread to the pan and, as instructed, gave them 3 to 4 minutes on each side until golden brown. Or, more realistically, until ghost white in some places and charred almost black in others. In the end, I threw two pieces away, ate one myself to make certain I wasn't feeding Oliver something actively poisonous, and piled the rest as attractively as I could on a plate. It was at about this point that I realised I'd forgotten to buy any toppings, so I grabbed some more of the agave nectar and gave it an artful drizzle. Okay, not artful exactly, but presentable. Then, waving my way through the billows of smoke that I'd mostly managed to confine to the kitchen area, and hoping I didn't smell too badly of charred almond milk, I went through to surprise Oliver with breakfast in bed. He was where I'd left him, in a crumple of duvet, dozing a kind of doze I recognised, the doze of somebody who didn't really want to be conscious, but whose body was all unconsciousnessed out. "I made French toast," I told him plaintively. He blinked, in a disorientated way.
"You did what?"
"Made French toast." For some reason it came out like an apology.
"Lucien, that's very sweet of you, but you realise it's not vegan."
"Obviously I realised it's not vegan. It's full of cow juice and chicken boxes. But I used substitutes. Because I'm amazing, and you're lucky to have me."
"You are, and I am, but..."
He cast his bleary eyes over my quite literally burnt offering.
"That looks ambiguous."
I perched myself on the edge of the bed. "Well, you have to eat. But I understand if you don't want to eat this." Pushing himself into a sitting position, he selected the least awful piece of French toast and ate it valiantly.
"Actually, out of everything you've made me, this is one of the least dreadful. Some bits of it are even quite nice."
"I'd take that." "There's also coffee," I said, "which I've definitely not fucked up." And for a while we sat in silence, sharing my okay French toast and my genuinely decent coffee. Oliver was looking slightly better than he had last night, which meant he was looking kind of like the zombie version of himself instead of the ghost version. He was propped against an artful construction of pillows, the duvet drawn to mid-chest height, picking at his late breakfast, early lunch with visibly increasing energy. At some point in the near future, he might even be standing upright. "So..." As ways to begin a conversation went, a long "so" was up there with, "Hi, have you considered changing your broadband provider?" "Do you want to talk? Or not talk? Or go for a walk? Or stay in bed? Or have me go away? Or..."
"At the moment, I think I'd mostly like you to stop listing things."
I took a deep breath. Sorry. How are you?
Not so great. My dad died.
Okay, so that was either a good sign because he had the strength to be sarcastic, or a bad sign because that's the answer I would have given, and I was a dick. Stop channeling me and be serious. You don't have to confide in me, but this was a big deal, and I'm worried about you.
I'm sorry to worry you, Lucien. And I will be... I'll be... Everything will be fine.
I know that, I told him, but it's obviously not fine right now. And I know you don't like feeling... I tried to express very gently through mime that you aren't living up to the unrealistic expectations foisted on you by your parents, one of whom is now dead. But I love you even when you're... I'd run out of gentle mimes. Crap. He laughed.
Wonderful pep talk, Lucien. Have you considered volunteering as a bereavement counsellor?
I just mean it's safe to be crap with me. Like I let myself be crap with you literally all the time.
You know that's not true.
He fixed me with a gaze that seemed to be saying about 12 different things at once.
Some of that French toast was really quite edible. Besides, I'm not with you for your cooking, or your ability to wash up. I'm with you because you make me feel better than anyone ever has. And I often wish I could be more like you.
Well, flustered by his sincerity, I poked him in the duvet lump where I thought his knee was. I don't want you to be anyone except yourself. And finally, my brain and heart and neuroses caught up with each other. If that means you need to deal with this on your own, then I get it, and I'll be here. With very Oliverian fastidiousness, he set the plate neatly on the bedside table.
The truth is, I don't think I'm dealing with it very well.
I'm not sure it's the kind of thing you can deal with well. I think people just feel what they feel and stumble through it.
Yes, but...
His eyes darkened to a miserable slate.
I think what I'm mostly feeling is angry.
Well, that seems pretty normal, I offered.
I'm sure it is. It is not, however, a helpful state to be in when one's arranging a funeral and trying to be there for one's mother.
Where's Christopher? Can't he help?
Christopher, said Oliver, with an edge of frustration, is in Afghanistan. He'll be back for the funeral, but not before. And I'm trying very hard not to resent him. But at the moment, this feels very typical.
I hoiked my feet onto the bed and crossed my legs. Tell you what, how about we draw a circle around this room and say that in here, you can be as bitter, resentful, and straight-up mean as you like. It won't hurt anyone, and no one will find out, and I won't think any less of you, because I couldn't, and also because I'm a horrible person anyway. Oliver didn't say anything for so long. I thought even the mystical power of the circle eventing couldn't overcome his fundamental need to give people the benefit of the doubt. Then he sucked in a breath like he was surfacing in the 100-meter butterfly.
I realise what Christopher does is very important and helps a lot of people, but it's incredibly fucking convenient that it means he's never around whenever anything needs doing. And I'd say if I didn't know better, I'd think he'd chosen his career specifically to keep 1,000 miles between him and his family, as much and as often as possible. But I can't say that because I don't know better, because it's fucking true. He's done this his whole life. From holidays with his friends when he was 16, to his gap year, to studying in Edinburgh, to his year abroad, to Médecins Sans Fucking Frontières. If they gave a medal to the most selfish, altruistic person in the world, Christopher would win it and then not show up at the ceremony.
I think it was air more than complaints that Oliver had run out of. The Christopher sucks speech had actually left him a little flushed, and I did feel sort of bad for Christopher, because while everything Oliver had said was probably accurate, given the Blackwoods, I'd have signed up with MSF as well. And from what Mia had told me the one time we'd met, they got their own flavour of shit from Oliver's parents.
Oh, God.
Oliver pressed his forehead to his knees.
I'm a terrible person.
I moved closer and put a hand on his back. Okay, I should have made the rules of the hate room clearer. Nobody is allowed to judge you here, including you. Oliver's shoulders heaved, and he made a sound like he wanted to cry, but couldn't.
It's just too much. He spent his whole life running away, and I've spent my whole life dealing with the things he's running away from, and it's never been good enough, and it'll never be good enough, and now it can't ever be good enough because our father is dead.
For a moment, I just stroked him in what I hoped was a comforting way. Listen, I said finally, you know how I said this was a no-judgment zone? Well, I'm going to say some really naff things now, and I need you not to tell anybody or laugh at me. He turned his face slightly towards me.
I shall make a sincere attempt, but it depends how naff they are.
Right, I naffed. I know your parents brought you up a certain way, but you can't... Oh, for fuck's sake, live your life trying to be good enough for other people. You have to be good enough for yourself. Although, for the record, you're definitely good enough for me.
Lucien, Lucien, Lucien.
I couldn't tell if he meant it as affection or admonition.
That was exceptionally naff.
I rolled my eyes at him in mock rebuke. Sometimes true things are naff and naff things are true. It's one of the many ways in which reality is bobbins. There was a tiny pause.
And, he said, and you're sure this is okay?
What's okay?
Saying these things. I'm not just convincing you that you're about to marry a whiny prick.
You're not being a whiny prick. I went back to my hopefully comforting stroking. This shit is clearly messing with you. It would mess with anyone. He gave a hollow laugh.
It would mess with anyone in similar circumstances. But I'm deeply aware, oh, woe is me, my affluent parents, whose cultural and literal capital gave me significant unearned advantages that most people can never access, and which I largely took for granted, were sometimes a bit emotionally unsupportive, isn't exactly the stuff of tragedy.
I was starting to feel like I'd misplayed noughts and crosses, and now Oliver had the centre and two corners, and wherever I went next, he was going to win. Oliver, I understand this is complicated, but you're forcing me to either be naff again or shit on your dead father, and I don't want to do either.
It's the room of hate, remember?
Oliver made a small encircling gesture.
So you can do both.
Okay, fine. Naff thing, your pain matters, even if other people have it worse. Shitting on your dead father thing, your parents were more than just sometimes a bit emotionally unsupportive. They're total fuckers who made you feel inadequate your whole life. And they're kind of homophobic.
Well, said Oliver, at least I only have one of them to deal with now.
My eyes went wide. Wow, really taking advantage of the safe room, aren't you?
As you may have noticed, Lucien.
Something like a smile touched his lips.
I seldom do things by halves. Besides, my mother's currently being difficult enough for the both of them.
Curling closer, I waited for Oliver to unleash himself.
Obviously, I sympathise, and it's natural that she's taking Dad's death quite hard. But as well as expecting me to organise everything, she also seems to blame me for everything. Up to and including the crematorium being busy, Christopher not being in the country, and, of course, the small matter of my father's death, which,
he scowled into the middle distance,
she hasn't said outright was directly caused by my standing up to him, but she has implied it several times.
I made a nervous, squeaky noise. You know she's, like, wrong, right? The pause that followed was longer than I would have preferred.
I do, actually. Although I can't lie, it's difficult when the last words you said to someone before they passed away were, "Go fuck yourself."
That hung there for a little bit, like neither of us knew what to do with it. "I'm so sorry," I said finally, falling into cliché and platitude.
"Don't be,"
Oliver shrugged.
"Well, of course I regret that we didn't have any kind of reconciliation before he... well, before that became impossible. What I mostly regret is that I didn't say it years ago."
That also hung there for a little bit.
"Too much?"
he asked. I shook my head. "Not even close. I mean, I'm just glad you're not feeling guilty."
"Oh, I'm feeling guilty as well. But I'm rather hoping that will pass."
There was a ring of finality in his voice. And I suppose that was all you could do with grief. Stick it out until you got used to it. Oliver squared his shoulders in a stiff upper lippy, pull yourself together-y sort of way.
"In any case," he went on, "given how brilliantly our wedding planning is going, I don't suppose you'd also like to help me organise a funeral."
Chapter 31.
"David Blackwood," said Oliver, "was a loving husband, a devoted father, and an absolute demon on the golf course. We all remember him as a fair and generous man, even if he didn't always suffer fools gladly. I remember when I was, perhaps, 14, we went to this restaurant somewhere in Berkshire, and the menu was all in French, and..."
He adopted a posture of studied relaxation.
"Well, anybody who knew my father would know that languages were not his strong point. So, when he ordered what he thought was a fillet steak, and the waiter brought him fish, the poor fellow got quite the earful. Of course, the manager was very apologetic, and I seem to recall we actually got a free bottle of wine by way of apology. I remember quite distinctly when we got home, and I looked it up, and discovered that filet de fleton did indeed mean halibut fillet. He looked me squarely in the eye and said, 'Well, it just goes to show, Oliver, it always pays to stand up for yourself.' And that was a lesson he always tried to pass on to both of his sons. And that's..."
A pause, and I couldn't quite tell whether he was really choking up or doing a very good job of faking.
"That's how I'll always remember him. How I think he'd always want to be remembered. As a force of nature, a man who fought for what he believed in, who demanded respect and always received it, even if it sometimes came at the expense of an otherwise blameless flatfish."
And here there was another of those appropriate laughter pauses.
"He was a provider, a caregiver, and a role model. And I can truly say that neither I nor Christopher would be the men we are today without his guidance. And on the subject of Christopher, I shall now surrender the lectern to my brother, who will read David's favourite poem, If."
There was a pause.
"Well?"
Oliver stared at me.
"What do you think?"
"Fine." I wasn't sure what else to say. Oliver frowned, then started pacing around my flat. He'd done quite a lot of pacing over the past week.
"Fine. It's my father's eulogy. It can't just be fine."
"I mean," I tried, "maybe you could tell a different story? That one makes your dad sound like a bit of a cock."
"Not to the people who'll be at the funeral."
Oliver slumped in a way that was almost a sigh.
"He used to tell it himself all the time. And if I left it out, Uncle Jim would be bound to come up to me afterwards and demand to know why I didn't tell the halibut story."
I tucked my feet under me on the sofa. "Oliver, you don't have to do this."
"I absolutely do. A funeral isn't like a wedding. You can't just say, 'Sorry, got cold feet. Enjoy the party.'"
"The eulogy, Oliver. There's no reason you have to speak. There's the vicar, there's Uncle Jim, there's Christopher. Your dad isn't going away unmemorialised."
"And you don't think..."
Oliver was frowning into the middle distance.
"If the vicar, Christopher and Uncle Jim all say something, and I pointedly don't, that won't seem deeply personal."
P. People will just assume you're too upset. I tried to catch his eye. If anything, it'll read as a loving tribute.
My mother would never forgive me, even if she believed me. And Christopher would never believe me, even if he forgave me.
This funeral stuff was hard. Not the logistics. They were pretty straightforward. I guess because it wasn't supposed to be the happiest day of anyone's life. But playing this constant game of emotional politics, where I wanted to support Oliver, and Oliver wanted to support his family, and Oliver's family wanted him to stand up and lie his arse off about what a great guy David Blackwood had been, was exhausting. Especially because I always felt I was losing. Okay, I said. But you're allowed to think about yourself as well.
It's a 3-minute speech.
At this point, I wasn't sure if he was trying to convince me or convince himself.
That's 3 minutes out of my entire life.
I sat on my hands to stop myself from getting all frustrated and gesticulatory. That's not how negative experiences work. And you're a lawyer. You don't need me to tell you that.
Your point is well made. But this isn't a trauma. It's an inconvenience. I'm going to say some things I don't entirely mean, although, to give myself credit, I don't think anything in the speech is strictly untrue.
Yeah, I couldn't help interrupting. You got a lot of mileage out of wouldn't be the men we are today. Oliver gave a sassy little nod.
Thank you. I'm glad you noticed. But nevertheless, all I have to do is stand up and pretend for a very short period of time that my relationship with my father was less complicated than it actually was. That's what everybody has done at every funeral that has ever happened.
I stared at him in his black suit and his black tie. He'd got that faintly hollowed out look he got when he'd been at the gym more than was probably psychologically healthy for him. But don't they also say that funerals are, you know, for the living? And you're the living?
Yes, he nodded. And so is everyone else.
Yeah, but there's, like, I pulled my hands out from under my arse and did the balancing scales mime. Like, you're doing something that hurts you a lot that might help other people a little bit. And that's like giving blood, but giving all of your blood. And yeah, you might save 2 people's lives, but you'd be dead. And if you give a little bit of your blood... I suddenly realised I'd run up against an analogy that, for most of our lives, neither of us had access to. Whenever you're allowed to...
So, said Oliver, in my case, not at all until the guidelines changed.
Okay, leaving aside homophobic medical policies and my failure to rhetoric properly, tell me honestly and tell yourself honestly how doing this speech will make you feel. There was a long silence. Then Oliver came and sat next to me.
Frankly, Lucien, it will make me feel miserable. I'm still very much working through what my relationship with my father was, or meant, and so putting it into a neat little box and tying that box with a neat little bow and attaching a neat little label that says, Beloved Husband, Devoted Father, is...
He broke off, and then finished in a resentful rush,
fucking with my head.
It would, I told him. It's a heady, fucky thing to have to do. Which is why I'm telling you, one last time, if you want to nope out, you can.
But?
No buts. I produced the assertive finger and waved it in the air. Blah, blah, family, blah, blah, expectation. Even with all that, if this is bad for you, that's the most important thing. Oliver heaved a sigh packed with so many different emotions that, if I'd wanted to, I could have sorted them alphabetically, starting with angry and ending with woeful.
I'm sorry, Lucien. I wish I could be that brave or that selfish, but ironically, it's not how I was raised. And I'm working on that. But my father was inconsiderate enough to die in the middle of the process rather than at the end of it. So, here I am, doing what is expected of me. Because right here and right now, I cannot imagine doing anything else.
And, I said, squeezing his hand tightly, I support you 100%. I didn't say, even if you don't support yourself, because that wasn't what he needed to hear. Besides, coming from me, it would have been kind of hypocritical.
If you supported me 100%,
Oliver's lips twitched,
you wouldn't be wearing the same suit to my father's funeral that you wore to your co-worker's wedding.
I did, in fact, have exactly one suit, not counting the blue one I'd rented for Bridges' blue and rose gold marital extravaganza. It's a multi-purpose item. It's both frugal and ethical. Standing, I gave Oliver my most morally superior face. Do you know how many litres of drinkable water go into producing a pair of formal trousers?
No,
said Oliver, looking, as I should have predicted, genuinely curious.
How many?
Well, I don't know either, but I bet it's a lot. And that was about as far as my cheer-up Oliver routine could run, because if we didn't leave soon, we'd be late. Or at least, not early enough to satisfy the ghost of David Blackwood. Even if I said so myself, we'd done a good job organisation-wise. Maybe because it had been clear from the outset how many rainbow balloon arches there should be, i.e. zero. Weirdly enough, this was actually going to be my first funeral. My dad's parents hadn't been in the picture, which was fitting since neither was he. My mum's dad, likewise, and my mum's mum was still very much alive in the south of France, preserved into her 90s by a diet of olive oil and red wine. In some ways, given how few shits I gave about David Blackwood, it was the least traumatic first funeral I could have been to. Apart from the tiny, tiny detail that there was a good chance it would utterly destroy my boyfriend's mental health. It was one of those sullen wintry days where it felt like the sky was scowling, too pissed off to even do the decent thing in rain. Various mourners were milling around the gardens and outside the main building, looking like mildly irritable shadow puppets. That was the thing about funerals. You were either distraught because the deceased was someone you were incredibly close to, or you were bored and awkward because they weren't, but some indirect tie of blood or friendship meant you were obligated to be there. Also, crematoria were fucking weird. They were basically a quite nice garden outside a factory for disposing of corpses, with a friendly, non-denominational chapel bolted onto the front. And to give them credit, they went to a lot of trouble to disguise the whole corpse disposal aspect of their business, but the honking great industrial chimney was a giveaway that my eyes kept drifting back to. The other eerily industrial thing about the crematorium experience was that, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, they didn't half pack them in. Which meant there was a 5-minute window between the last service ending and ours beginning. So while Oliver went inside to, I don't know, greet the vicar, hug his mum, have his shirt criticised for old time's sake, I was left trying to herd a bunch of people who didn't know who I was, or have reason to listen to me, into a building they didn't want to be in for a very tight turnaround. I didn't think I made any friends, but it would have been weird if I had. And, after a little while, Mia was there to help, because this was apparently the partner's job. Or maybe she just wanted to get away from the rest of her husband's family. On the whole, I was proud that we managed to get everyone in and ourselves into our embarrassingly front row seats, bang on the dot of 11. One of the artfully reassuring people who worked at the crematorium closed the doors behind us. And then, well, that was showtime. There was something about the chapel itself that I found oddly calming, probably because it had been designed to oddly calm people. The chairs were relatively comfortable and upholstered in a neutral shade of blue, and everything around us was soothing pine and soft uplighting, making it almost possible to ignore the little curtain door with the coffin in front of it. Much like a wedding, the vicar kicked us off, although out of deference to the Blackwoods' fairly common brand of C of E secularism, he'd agreed to keep the God stuff to a minimum and focus instead on remembering the life of David Blackwood, which mostly meant his work, his family, golf, and tireless support of the local Conservative Party. My brain really wanted to maintain a running commentary as a kind of defence mechanism, but given I was sitting one space away from Miriam, who was crying softly and, I thought, sincerely, I wasn't quite that much of a prick. Beside me, Oliver was growing increasingly tense, his hands white-knuckled against his knees. "You still don't have to do this," I whispered. "Just tell the vicar you're too upset. He must get that all the time." Oliver bent his head close to mine.
I can't.
"And now," said the vicar, in what I'm sure must have been his trained funeral voice, "we hand over to David's eldest son, Oliver, who's going to say a few words." I made a weird grab for Oliver's hand, like he'd just slipped over a cliff, and it was my last chance to catch him. But since this was a funeral, and therefore the force pulling him forward was social convention and not gravity, it didn't. Taking the vicar's place at the lectern, Oliver took a stack of cue cards from his inside pocket and cleared his throat. I tried to shoot "I love you and I'm here for you" lasers out of my eyes, already terrified of how much this was going to hurt him. The silence somehow got deeper as it lengthened. The vicar patted him reassuringly on the arm. Then Oliver straightened his spine, fixed his gaze squarely at the back of the room, and began to speak.